The Low Post is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven.
And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to a very special edition of The Low Post podcast. The NBA season is over, and I will start this by saying about 8 months ago, a couple of friends of mine, neighbors, said, you gotta sit down and do Ted Lasso. You have to do it. You're not going to regret it. And I said, that's the one where they did those commercials on NBC like 10 years ago. They made a whole show out of that. They said, just trust us and do it. And most decisions I make in life are bad in general. That's the best decision I made the entire year. Ted Lasso is a national treasure. It returns for season 2 on Apple TV today by the time this goes up. And joining me on the Low Post podcast, co-creator, co-star is the mysterious, enigmatic Coach Beard. Brendan Hunt, it is an honor. How are you doing?
What an intro, Zach. Oh, my God. Yikes. I mean, I feel like every episode is probably a special episode, but then I was already going to call you out on that. But then you kept going. Oh, you're sweet. I'm good. It's frantic right now. It's very busy. I'm very happy to be here. I've been reading you for years. So the pleasure is mine, sir.
20 Emmy nominees. The whole cast got nominated, basically, including you. You're an Emmy nominee, among many other things. 20 Emmy nominations, which is like, I thought only Game of Thrones kind of shows where there's a cast of like 9,000 people and they get every special effects nomination and edit. I thought only those kind of shows could get so many nominations. A Peabody Award, which is like, what? The Peabody Award? That's like if I won the Pulitzer Prize. That's insane. And just the success of the show is unbelievable. It's completely well-deserved. You guys have created something very, very special. So I will start by asking you this. It's known as the Sweet Show. The Peabody Awards said it was the antidote to toxic masculinity, which I guess if you're going to be an antidote to something, the virus would be the first thing to be the antidote to, and toxic masculinity would be up there. How did you manage, though, and as a writer, to make a show that's sweet without being saccharine? Like, what are the steps you took to make sure we hit that sweet spot, no pun intended, where, yeah, it's sweet and positive and happy, but it's not sugary. It's not a romantic comedy. It's not going to make people roll their eyes. What were the steps to get there?
We say f- a lot. That's kind of our secret weapon, because most shows that, you know, have, you know, been described by people as being this kind of, you know, positive thing, you know, Highway to Heaven, or something like those are very, very, you know, conservative sort of shows, I guess, you know, and they want to be super family friendly and not piss off any sponsors. We want to sound like the world sounds, you know. We want to talk how people actually talk. And I think that is some, you know, those two things together are two things that don't often go together. And maybe that's what, you know, is helping people sort of find the whole thing, you know, helpful or realistic, is that it appears, you know, if you use the language of the real world, then it's easier to believe that even the show with as ridiculous a premise as this is taking place in the world you live in.
Brett Goldstein, who plays Roy Kent, the jaded veteran soccer player, is instant. I had never seen him before. I want to know about how you found him and all that, but he is instantly like top five all-time F-bomb droppers. He'll ride that F like, fuck! Like it's, I was rewatching some scenes today. He is an unbelievable dropper of the F-bomb, and I don't even have a question. Did you realize that? He has a chance to be what Clay Davis was for he has a chance to be for the F-bomb.
Wow, there's no higher compliment than to be the Clay Davis of another word. You know, I mean, that character is based loosely on Roy Keane, and Roy Keane was very, you know, who played for those who wouldn't know, he played for Manchester United on their best teams, and he played for the Republic of Ireland, and he was famously very combustible and very foul-mouthed. He quit Ireland right before a World Cup because he hated the manager, and if I had this right, the quote attributed to him was "shove it up your bollocks," which doesn't sound that dirty to us, but apparently it's pretty dirty over there. And it's also not physically possible. I don't know how you shove things up your testicles. Anywho, every we have is an attempt to honor the beautiful source material that is the original RK. Oh, sorry, I mean, I should add though, but Brett's f-ing fantastic. You know, Brett.
Also Emmy right. nominated. Also Emmy nominated.
Yep, yep. But yeah, he makes every a tiny melody.
How so? Correct me if I'm wrong, but I know this is not wrong. But the show is shot in London or in the UK, and I believe you guys fought. You and Jason Sudeikis, whose name we probably should have said by now, he is Ted Lasso, fought hard for that. And I actually think as a viewer, it makes a difference. Just the scenes of him walking from his apartment on the streets of, I think it's supposed to be Notting Hill, right? Like that, it just lends an authenticity to it. But my follow-up question would be, did it help you find local English, both extras and co-stars? And how did you, like some of these people I've never seen before, how did you find them? Was it just an audition process? They came in with lots of other people?
Yeah, basically everyone auditioned, and none of us had worked with any of these people before, with the exception being that Bill Lawrence, our showrunner, had worked with Brett on something a few years ago. But Juno is the only person, along with Anthony Head, who got offers, but everyone else, yeah, just auditioned. And they got a ton of good actors over there. And they can all do anything, you know, like these scripts in our show, there's a lot of push pull between, you know, quote unquote, heavy moments and comedy moments. And we like to turn on a dime, and it has been no problem for any of these people. And they're all a good hang too, which, you know, that's part of why we all have such a good time on this thing. Everyone's pretty damn cool. No turkeys, as Jason says.
If you haven't watched season one of Ted Lasso and you care about not knowing plot developments, I mean, it's a comedy, but there are plot developments. Stop listening now. That's your spoiler alert. I don't know the timetable of how you shot season one, but was there a plot line or a character development that like midway through changed? And by the end, you're like, wow, I didn't know that we would end up here, but we ended up here and it really worked.
Not while we were shooting it, but while we were writing it, there was a big change. You know, me and Jason and Joe Kelly, the original creators of the show, long ago had written, you know, an outline for a season, and we didn't want it to be a typical sports movie arc where these plucky underdogs win the title at the end. That's just not that's too unrealistic even for this show. But also, it would be kind of like wonderfully soccer of it if, like, it's the battle for relegation, which is, or to not be relegated, which is something that that people don't really know here. But we'd introduce them to it, we'd set it up, and we'd show them the stakes. And for, you know, years, we're like, oh yeah, okay. And we set up relegation. Then at the end, you know, happy ending, they don't get relegated, and on we go. And then like 2 months into the writer's room, Bill Lawrence, who was, you know, I think must have been spending the previous 2 months getting familiar with the definition of relegation, as Ted does, finally out of nowhere goes, we talk about relegation so much, at the end, they should just get relegated. He's right. And that was a big material change. And I think that ending fits the series much, much better. And I think it's a big reason why... Well, it's another reason why people get attached to this show. Because, like, I know I found in my soccer fandom, I think the spoiler might be over now. In my soccer fandom, I've gotten attached to teams more by watching them lose the big game than win the big game. And I guess that's true in a lot of sports. But, like, watching Holland after I moved to Amsterdam, watching them lose the European Championship semifinal was like, I'm Holland for life now. Like, this is the worst thing I've ever felt, and I don't ever want to feel this again. And I don't know, is that unique to soccer, really? I don't think so. I bet there's plenty of one-off games people have had their heart broken over.
You're a Chicago guy, and I think the Cubs and the Red Sox both, I don't know that they lost something when they finally won, but the nature of supporting the teams probably changed, right? Are you a Cubs fan?
As a Northside child of Southside parents, I have a complicated relationship with Chicago baseball in general. But I've been to more Cubs games than Sox games.
Okay, fair enough. So you mentioned the unrealistic, even for a show like this. The magic trick that you did, I don't know how you did it, was to simultaneously lean in to the preposterousness of a football coach being offered a Premier League soccer coaching job without any knowledge of how soccer works. You leaned into it. You acknowledge it. You look it in the face. It's part of the show. You don't look away from it. But at the same time, it's played straight. You know, I don't even know how to explain it. It's played straight by all the characters. They all acknowledge it, but they all just sort of say, okay, this is our reality. We're going to just work within it. And I don't know how you struck that balance, but it's like a magic trick, because my assumption was we'll just stop talking about how ridiculous it is and it'll be a show about something else. But it's always in the show. How did you do that?
Well, you know, we were, I don't want to say saddled with that premise, but that premise was what we started with, you know, because that was the commercial. And, you know, in improv, we have, you know, me, Joe, Jason come from an improv background. There's the philosophy of, you know, the worst idea with the best support, or the worst idea with the most support beats the best idea with the least support. And so, yeah, you know, Mike Gundy suddenly working at Watford is a horrible idea. So let's support the hell out of it. You know, let's go in all guns blazing. And then separately from that, because the idea is so ridiculous, I think it was beholden on us to surround that premise with real characters, you know, and real people, and try to depict this whole thing as realistically possible, so that at the very least this crazy ass thing is taking place in a real world.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facility safe and your people safer. Call or click Grainger.com or just stop by. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because of the eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This is a basketball podcast nominally, so let's do some basketball stuff. Because you and Jason Sudeikis is obviously a big NBA fan, there are NBA references sprinkled into this show, including one of which I'm not sure anyone has noticed that we're going to talk about. Only I would notice, because I'm a crazy person. But the most famous one was the recreation of Allen Iverson's practice rant. And the twist on it is it's the coach giving the practice rant at the player and not the other way around. And a lot of it is verbatim. There are obviously deviations because the sports are different and all that. And for people who haven't seen it, it's an amazing rendition by Jason Sudeikis as Ted Lasso of Allen Iverson's practice rant. How did you decide to do this? How did you execute it? And how did you decide to have the coach sort of reverse the roles and be the one giving the rant?
It happened in the flow of a writer's room session, talking about, I think we weren't even talking about that episode yet. We were just kind of talking about things in general. And then, yeah, as things just sometimes come up randomly, Allen Iverson's speech came up, and immediately it was like, oh, Ted gives that speech, but he's advocating for practice over a game as opposed to a game over practice. Yes, boom, file that away. And, like, you know, only about half our writer's room, you know, knows that reference or whatever. So some were like, okay, what else are we talking about? But those of us knew what it was like, okay, there's f-ing something there. That's really f-ing funny. And it was Jason who eventually chose where to put it. And I also think in the end, you know, his final touches on it and definitely his performance of it really elevated it into this great moment. And I, I'll always wonder, because I'll never be able to experience it this way, what it's like to watch that scene having no idea that we're making a reference. It must seem so weird to just be like, why? He's really yelling.
So my wife
is repeating himself.
My wife is not familiar with the Allen Iverson practice rant. So, but as someone who knows it, I had my own delightful sensation, which is the first time he says practice, it doesn't really register. And then he says it again, and you have this wonderful waterfall of the thing dawning on you, like, they're doing the Iverson practice rant. And I had to stop the show and explain. So there was this player who complained about practice and like the speech. I was like, the speech is exactly the same. It's exactly the same. How many takes did people start laughing? Did the cast get the joke? Like, tell me more.
I think we probably, with all the different, coverage, camera angles that we got of it, probably did 10 or 15 takes total. And that allowed Jason to have 10 or 15 takes of getting closer to getting it right, in terms of the words themselves. But for the most part, the cast and crew had no idea what we were doing. So it was between one of the camera moves or during one of the camera moves that Jason finally got his phone out and, 12 dudes in Richmond shirts gather around a phone and watch this speech and like, oh, okay. And, Jason really gets into the backstory on that too, of what Iverson was going through at the time. There's been a few moments like that during the course of the season. I wish I could remember others, but where it's like, we're doing a thing. The cast doesn't quite get it. They just give it full commitment anyway. And then afterwards we explain it and they're like, that's great. Except, in a Cockney accent.
So the commercials were like 2013, 14, I think, something like that. Then you have this idea for a show that, what did you begin shooting? 2019, 2020? I don't know how shooting schedules work, something like that. There's 6 or 7 years there. What was the moment when you thought for the first time, oh my God, this, we might actually get to do this. Like, this isn't just a pipe dream that we have. Like, when did it become, not like when did you strike the deal, but when did it become like, oh, we might actually get to do this?
It was when Jason said the words Bill Lawrence for the first time. Bill Lawrence is our showrunner and the fourth creator of the show. For folks who don't know him, he made Scrubs and Spin City. He wrote on the first season of Friends. Cougar Town is his as well. And as Jason is fond of saying, he's forgotten more about television than any of us will ever know. And Bill Lawrence gets things done. And once Jason was like, hey, is all our Ted Lasso material that we kind of workshop for a while, is that still online somewhere? I'm like, yes, man, that's how the internet works. Okay, cool. I'm talking to Bill Lawrence tomorrow. And sure enough, 3 months later, me and Jason and Joe are having dinner with Bill Lawrence. And 2 months after that, we're in a writer's room.
Unbelievable. It's an unbelievable success story. And I've read a lot of the interviews you've done in the past month. You've been asked a gazillion times, like, how does it feel when it becomes a hit? When did you know that it was becoming a hit? What's the piece of feedback where you were like, oh my God, it's becoming a hit? So I don't know. I want to ask that question differently, but I don't quite know how to ask it differently. It must continue to happen every day now. There must be something every day, a direct message, an interview, a coach referencing Be a Goldfish, like Quinn Snyder of the Utah Jazz did. It just must be a daily occurrence at this point, right?
It can feel like that. Yeah. Just people come out of the woodwork who we never would have thought would be even watching our show. And then they'll just get on Twitter and shout about it, like Barry Jenkins and Maureen McCormick and Kerry Washington and Bo Willimon and Steve Kerr, hero of my youth, Steve Kerr.
What did Steve Kerr say? I missed this.
He had a tweet about it. Like shortly after the show came out, I forget what it was. It was really lovely. Sidebar, we had a new writer's assistant for season two, a guy, Matthew, kid trying to make it in this business. And I wasn't there the day he got introduced or something, but it's like, it's all over Zoom. We're having a good time. And then one day, I slowly start to realize, oh, this kid's 19. I think he's living with his parents. Okay, cool. Do-do-do-do. We come back from lunch once, and there's someone on the Zoom. There's someone in Matt's room, and Matt's his last name is Kerr. And I go, I go, is that your dad? He's like, yeah, your dad looks like Steve Kerr. I look closer. Holy shit, that's Steve Kerr. Steve Kerr just leans in and gives a wave and off he goes. But I still think he was, you know, his tweet about the show was sincere and not just trying to help his son's gig get pushed along.
So I don't, I ran into the Warriors contingent in Chicago for the draft combine, and this topic came up and I completely forgot about it until you just brought up Steve Kerr, that his son is involved in the show. And I can confirm for you that Steve Kerr was overjoyed that he had found someone else who wanted to talk about Ted Lasso out of nowhere. And then we just like grinned at each other and we're like stupid slobbering idiots talking about how much we love Ted Lasso. That's amazing. And by the way, it's coming. The Obama tweet is coming. It's just a matter of time. Like that's what the crescendo is going to be. It feels like an Obama show. He likes sports. It's going to happen.
You know, we didn't make his end of 2020 list of things to watch. So I don't know. Maybe we missed the boat there. I was hoping we'd get there, but oh well.
Okay, another deep cut NBA reference is I don't know how I noticed this, but scanning the locker nameplates of Richmond FC, it must be a scene where there's panning across the locker room from player to player, and the nameplates are in the background. I see Kukoc 7. And I'm like, I don't think we've met a character called Kukoc. Someone in this writer's room is a Bulls fan and has just inserted this Easter egg for lunatics like me to get very excited about. Was this you?
I was a driving force in the Kukoc, yes. When, you know, one of the fun parts of doing this was, you know, we had characters who had names and we were going to cast those people, but then we still needed names to fill out the world. And I just thought, like, well, every Premier League team has at least one Eastern Bloc person. Not always Croatian, but often Croatian. Let's honor the waiter. Let's get him in there. I will love Tony Kukoc for all my days. There is one of our extras, you know, SAs, who's around but doesn't have any lines, is Kukoc. He is there.
Okay.
But yeah, he is yet to figure into any stories, but yeah, good eye.
Well, just know that it brings, I don't know how many people noticed. There's probably stuff I haven't noticed like that, but it brought me great, great joy.
If only starting your fitness journey was as easy as starting this podcast. The truth is, all the lift big, get big, and beach body ready in 3 weeks pressure stops most of us from even starting. And starting is what matters most. It's everything. Wherever you're beginning, wherever you want to be, Peloton encourages you to just start. With thousands of classes to get you moving and doing what you can. If that's a 10-minute low impact class, they've got those. And when you're ready, take it up a gear with a 30-minute live DJ ride. Start with Peloton and find instructors that will keep you motivated to stay on your fitness journey, learn the basics, and build from there. Remember, doing something is everything. Get started with a Peloton bike or bike plus rental at onepeloton.com/bike/rentals. Terms apply.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes! Catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems with nothing on your roof. So who's there up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, watch out for them. You name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit directtv.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Let's talk about some of the iconic scenes from the first season. The most famous one is probably the darts game scene between Ted and evil Rupert. And it's got a gazillion hits on YouTube. It's a delightful scene. And it's based on the Walt Whitman quote, "Be curious, not judgmental." This is what Ted Lasso is more or less lecturing evil Rupert about. Who decided, where did that quote come from? I know where it came from. It came from Walt Whitman, but where did it come from into the show's universe?
That's all Jason. you know, he knows that quote, and he, and, you know, it may or may not have come from Walt Whitman. That may be apocryphal, but it's certainly associated with him. And it's just a great quote. You know, it's a great way to look at life. And yeah, I think that speech wasn't even originally in that script. You know, getting close to shooting that scene, Jason just kind of came up with it. And he put that in, and it's a bit of a testament to, you know, honor your ideas when you have them, because even if they don't get much time to marinate, they might be really good, because there was a fairly short lead in, if I recall correctly, between him coming up with that and us actually getting it on screen. And, yeah, it's pretty cool to see how much people dig it.
Who and how decided to have him say barbecue sauce before the last bullseye?
That was Jason. And actually there was a little more, there was like one more sentence before that, that was cut. So there was context for barbecue sauce. I think it works much better without context, because I love watching people just try to like figure out what the hell that means or what's going on there. Kind of wonderfully enigmatic. Yeah, there was a line before that. I don't remember what the line was. I wasn't even on set that day, because I was finishing writing the next episode. But yeah, the standalone barbecue sauce is you can't see me. Chef's kiss, people. It's a chef's kiss.
My favorite part of that scene, and I it's beautiful, and I mean that in the most sort of soulful way, is the reaction shots from Hannah Whittingham, who plays Rebecca, the team owner and Rupert's ex-wife. It's just an unbelievable bit of acting, a combination of happiness and overcome with emotion, facial expressions. I don't know if you were involved at all in the editing of that scene and the setting of that scene, but it's just, I'm always fascinated by these artistic decisions. Like it would be easy to just film Jason and Rupert, the actor who plays Rupert, and nothing else. I mean, there's some generic crowd reaction, but filming her as a major part of the scene it rounds it out perfectly. I don't know if you have any insight into that, but I just thought Hannah Whittingham was also nominated for an Emmy, like everybody. I might get nominated for an Emmy after this podcast. I just thought that was an absolute, like, I don't know. I've never seen her before. That scene alone would have made me a huge fan of hers.
Hannah's amazing. And yeah, I mean, it's good directing and good editing, because, you know, you're shooting her coverage anyway. And just leave, you know, you just leave a camera on her to see if the editor will be able to use it. And it turns out that she's amazing, and even just silently watching. And yeah, you pepper that into what he's doing, and it is I'm glad you call it out, 'cause it's one of the sort of less mentioned elements of the recipe of that scene that make it sing.
Is Ted Lasso saying, so Rupert has a very cocky moment where he says, oh, we're going to play darts for this massive wager. Oh, I forgot I have my personal dart collection on me. And Ted Lasso says, oh, well, I forgot I'm left-handed. Is that an intentional homage to The Princess Bride, or just it just happened by accident?
Oh, no, that's intentional. To Princess Bride and to Mandy Patinkin, fellow Kenwood Academy graduate, along with Chaka Khan. And Nazi Muhammad as well.
Oh, okay. How are you feeling about the Chicago Bulls, by the way? I know because you've been overseas, it's been hard for you to follow the team. We were DMing on Twitter the day of the Vucevic trade, and obviously they didn't make the play-in. Zach LaVine had to be out for health and safety protocols. I don't know. I know you're a big, big fan, but how are you feeling about the state of the team?
Cautiously optimistic, you know, with the regime upstairs, really. And, you know, when they got Billy Donovan, I was like, what? We were able to get Billy Donovan? Okay. That's uncharacteristic of us. I don't want to spoil it. I will say I was watching that draft lottery with a lot of hope in my heart. Too bad. So was that actual basketball talk? Do you think that ends up being a good trade? Losing a high pick for Vucevic?
I was on the day of the trade that I remember saying, I like this less for the Bulls and more for the Magic than consensus seems to be. Like, I think it'll be fine. Vooch is a really good player. He pairs well with LaVine, but I thought Orlando did amazing to get that much for a 31-year-old center who's a defensive liability, and I didn't really love it for the Bulls and was worried that they were going to trap themselves into just being an okay team for a while. I think there's some hope within the Bulls that some free agent somewhere will look at those two guys and say, oh, those guys would be fun to play with. Like, they'd be a draw for another really good player. We'll see. I do like Pat Williams, though. I think, Pat, I don't know if you've gotten to watch him at all, the young kid they draft. I think he's going to be really good.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I feel better about myself now.
Who came up with the idea of Ted Lasso making cookies every day for the team owner?
I cannot remember. I can't remember. It might have been Joe Kelly, the aforementioned Joe Kelly, who is the writer of that second episode. That's my guess. Would be Joe Kelly. But it certainly has been a fun runner, and it was a fun thing to, like, you know, find the right moment in the season to make that reveal, which I think came out pretty well too.
It did. I suspected that it was him that making them, but it was good to have my suspicions confirmed. So I told you I was going to ask you this before. What's a scene, whether you're in it or not, that's maybe not one of the iconic scenes, an under the radar scene, maybe there's not even a great joke in it anywhere, but that for some reason is near and dear to your heart as one of the creators of this thing?
There in episode 4, which is the gala episode, Rupert's first appearance and all that, there's a bunch of great stuff, but one sort of table setting scene is literally at a table, which is the moment when Roy and Jamie realize they've been sat at the same table. And then Ted says, and Roy tries to go away, and he's like, no, sit down, I parent trapped y'all. That's just a great little scene of, like, bouncing around. You know, Juno, who plays Keeley, and Phil Dunster, who plays Jamie Tartt, and Brett, who plays Roy, and Nick, who plays Nate, and Mr. Sudeikis. They all have moments in that scene that it's really, really fun. The first time we're seeing those five characters together, it kind of sets the tone for some relationship stuff, you know, in the love triangle. And it has one of my absolute favorite jokes of the whole series, which is when Keeley compliments Nate on his suit and he says, thank you, it's the first suit I've ever owned. It's the second suit I've ever owned. The first one was when I was a naked baby.
I rewatched that scene today and nobody laughs. And to me, the funniest part of it is when Ted Lasso says, the term birthday suit would really helped you there.
Yes. That kills me every time.
Jamie Tartt, Phil Dunster is shirtless during that scene for some reason. And that scene also has a very good joke related to the parent trapping, which is that Ted Lasso says, I just admire the writing of jokes because I can't do it. And I just am fascinated by the process. So the joke is Ted Lasso says, I like my, because there's locker room dispute between Roy and Jamie, the old veteran and the young cocky hotshot who's a jerk and selfish at that point in the series, not making the extra pass, which is his NBA expression that gets into the show. And Ted Lasso says, I like my locker rooms like my mom's swimsuit, in one piece. Like, how many versions of that joke are there? Are there other, like, I like my locker rooms like, and then there's like seven other punchlines that you chose this one over?
No, I think in that case, that was the clear one, because, you know, one piece bathing suit is a phrase that exists. So I think one piece let us right there. It is one of two jokes we have during the course of the season that are about a mother or mother-in-law's bathing suit, though, which is something we need to explore more or less. I'm not sure, but it's weird that we do it twice.
You have this brand of joke that is almost 30 Rock-ish. And Jason Sudeikis was, of course, on 30 Rock as Liz Lemon's love interest. It's a joke that is like a normal conversation is happening, and then a joke sort of organically emerges and takes over the conversation. So the one that I was watching today, I just happened to see it, was, I don't remember even the context, but Ted Lasso says he's asked for some advice or something, and he says, you know, I have two lessons in life. The first is, never take a candy bar on the playground from whatever the kid's name was when I was in elementary school, because he might have touched it. So that's like a genre of joke where someone, there's a normal conversation, and then somehow it turns into the setup for this joke that's very 30 Rock-ish, and there's a lot of that. I don't even, like, that, I just picture you guys in the writer's room being like, okay, here's the conversation. Where can we implant these jokes? And just a rapid fire competition for who can, is that how it is? Like, because it's, and also you risk become, I think 30 Rock almost had too many jokes. Like there were just so many jokes, you couldn't hear all of them. You have the, you guys strike the right balance of getting those in there, but they, without seeming like it's taking over the show.
Well, I mean, we all love 30 Rock. I mean, that's straight up one of the best TV shows of all time. And 30 Rock was so incredibly dense that, you know, I not quite consciously, but we knew we wouldn't be able to do what they do in any kind of meaningfully better way. You know, like that having a show at that pace has now been done, and it's been done the best it'll ever be done. So clap your hands and find something else. So we go at a slower pace, but we do still try to be, you know, a more like a more of a loping dense, I guess. And in terms of how jokes get in, I guess it's sort of like mini competitions in the moment, but like we just spitball. And sometimes a joke, you know, doesn't necessarily fit the scene we're working on. So we write it on a card and we put it on the joke wall. And then later on when we're like, we need a joke in this scene, we look to the joke wall and see if any of those that we loved in the moment can find a new home. But yeah, those are digressions is what they're called.
Digressions, and, yes.
And writing digressions for Ted is definitely like something we spend chunks of time on in the writer's room. But in the end, Jason's better writing those than any of us are. But we try.
I wish digression is thank you for giving me the technical term, because that helps me just talk about it. But the show is full of those, and Ted is full of them. That's how he talks. That's how he is in conversations. It's a lot of his conversations with Rebecca are like that. And I don't know if there's one that comes to mind that you really, really loved or just felt like was amazing. But I just to give listeners like another idea of what we're talking about.
Oh boy, there's just so many that he has. There's one in the pilot, or not the pilot, but the first episode of season two, which will be out in a few hours, that is in a scene that he and I have together where it's in the pub and he's about to talk to me about, you know, being concerned that the team is bringing a sports therapist. And for no good reason, we first have to exchange like 8 lines about the gin blossoms. In the middle of this conversation. And then we finally get back into it. And then the gin blossoms are done. We don't talk about them anymore. But yeah, we have them all the time, and I love them.
Well, about Coach Beard's relationship status, Ted Lasso says, Coach Beard thinks relationships are like steaks. You know, you spend more than 5 minutes on any one of them, they lose their flavor. It's just like, I don't know how you keep a straight face during these. About not being saccharine. A scene that I just thought as a viewer, it's more than one scene, but an angle that I thought was important for that was when Ted has like a one night stand in a hotel with one of Rebecca's friends. And not that I don't think that's a bad thing. I think Ted seems to think it's a bad thing that he's done, or an immoral thing that he's done. I don't think it's bad. I just think it humanizes him because he's created this problematic situation where he feels guilty. The woman doesn't feel guilty at all. She's like, I had a great time. I'm going to order breakfast and all that. How did you decide to write that, to show his vulnerability, to show, because I do think that scene just as a viewer was important to me to like humanize him in a different way.
Yeah, we wanted to, because the danger with making danger is probably not quite the right term, but a risk you can run into with having a character who is, you know, so much of a like, you know, human instrument of goodness, is that he can be asexual or non-sexual. And if he's asexual or non-sexual, well, some people might say, then he's not fully human. So we didn't want him to be, we didn't want him to be that. You know, we wanted to show that side of him somewhere. And this organically was the place to do it. And we really loved putting in that, you know, structuring it in such a fake out way that the audience kind of goes, oh my God, is that Rebecca at his door? Because, you know, for a brief period in the writer's room, it was going to be Rebecca. And then we're like, no, that should be protected. We need to protect that relationship at all costs. That should never happen. But we can get sassy in there, and that'll be as fun or more.
Well, part of the reason why it works is not just because he feels guilty and all this. It's because it shows he's not unaware of his appeal. He knows he's charming. He knows he's handsome. And he knows, like, he's pretty confident. He's got away with him. Like, I think, to your point, Mr. Good Guy is usually like, oh, people like me? Oh, wow, what a happy bonus of my goodwill. Ted is, in that moment, aware of, oh, I have this going on for me.
Yeah, he's just real, you know, or as real as his dad can be. Yeah.
So here's the joke. I told you I was rewatching some scenes and I heard a joke that I didn't hear the first time. It's from that scene. So she wakes up and Ted has got her an extended checkout and said, I got to go, but you know, you do whatever you want. She says, well, I'm going to order a huge breakfast room service on your tab. And he says, I'm happy to be your Underhill anytime. I'm happy to be your Underhills anytime. And I said, wait a second, did he say Underhills? Is this like an obscure Fletch reference about when Fletch goes to the country club and orders everything on the Underhills tab? How in the hell do you land there? And how are you okay with the fact that like an astronomical percentage of viewers are not going to have any idea what that joke is?
Well, I mean, we're all Fletch fans, particularly Bill and Jason. I mean, I think they're, you know, part of the start of them getting together was exploring the possibility of any kind of, you know, of working on Fletch. But, you know, I mean, the Underhills reference just comes naturally because that's exactly what's happening. And in terms of people not getting it, we have a million jokes like that. Like basically 100% of our jokes will not be gotten by 100% of the people. And so we don't mind if, you know, 10% of the jokes are only gotten by 2% of the people, as long as it's a different 2% every time. So, you know, that's why you get your occasional references, your occasional Iverson rant, and a few, you know, soccer Easter eggs that people might not get, but we don't linger on them long enough that it does any damage so much. You know, it's fun to have one of those when you're in a live theater, you know, like during a play or something where like, just, you know, 500 people say, and like you say a joke that you know is funny, but you know that only 3 people are going to laugh, but then they do. And it makes everyone else go, okay, I didn't get that, but the show is still good, apparently. Apparently they're still doing funny things. So I continue to listen.
I didn't even notice it, and I was delighted today when I did notice it. And there are a lot of jokes like that in the show, as you said. This may be a dumb question, but did Ted Lasso always have the same voice? Did Jason just nail it on the first time, or have there been other Ted Lasso accents that were workshopped at some point? Because the voice is, it's perfect. I love it.
I think that is a voice that is in his, you know, his infinite jukebox or Lazy Susan or whatever, you know, a variegated messenger system you want to, you know, analogize. He had done it on SNL a time or two, but like not, it was never like a signature thing, you know, it was never like a signature character per se. But so that has always been the voice from the moment, you know, we first met at his house in the hills to to just, you know, vomit notes and bits out onto a few legal pads. That was always Ted's voice, and yeah, there's never been much variance from it.
We're going one episode at a time, right? Or that's how you're releasing it, one a week or one, what is it?
Yeah, one a week this time. The first season was 3 at once and then one more after a week. And then, I mean, we kind of wrote the first part of the season thinking that the first 3 episodes would come out at once. Then they're like, no, one a week. I'm like, oh, okay, no, it's fine. But yeah, but the trade-off is this time there's 2 more episodes. So yeah, a good little bit.
As someone who is both patient but also knows that I would watch the whole show in 2 nights. Thank you. I like this way better. It's going to give me something to look forward to every week or whenever it comes out. Tea, English tea. Keep hammering it. I hate tea. I don't get tea. It's an endless source of delight for me that Ted Lasso hates tea. Is that going to, without spoiling anything, are we going to get a recurrence of that joke at all in season 2?
Yes. Okay. In short, you will. Yeah, I've never got it with tea either, and I'm such a f***ing, you know, European wannabe. You'd think I'd have adopted it by now. And every couple of years, I'll have a cup of tea, like just like, you know, to check in. But yeah, it's never grabbed me. And I'm a huge coffee guy now, and I know tea is better for you than coffee in pretty much every way possible.
I don't care. I don't care about the health. I don't care about the health information. I don't care. I don't care about it. Today's interview has been fueled by Gatorade. Whatever path you take to greatness, Gatorade is there to fuel it. Greatness starts with G. All right, you're very busy. You're promoting this show all over the place. It doesn't even need promotion anymore. That's the cool thing about it. But is there anything we didn't hit that you want to hit? Is there any part of the show's journey we didn't hit that you want to talk about, or anything you want to say about season two or anything like that? The floor is yours.
This is my third interview of the day, so I'm a little brain fried and I hate the sound of my own voice. But you had mentioned something about wanting to ask about Grace Notes.
Yes. There was an interview that either you or Jason gave, I can't remember, talking about how because your episodes can be longer than like an 18-minute televised sitcom or 22 minutes or whatever the sitcom length with commercials is, you guys can let scenes linger. And I think it was Jason that said we can have these grace notes. And the interview kind of left it there, and it made me think, like, what are they actually talking about? So what does that mean? Or what is a grace note in the Ted Lasso universe?
Yeah, so it's a very specific musical term that I will not attempt to define, because I will do it slightly wrong. But the examples of it in the show, because you've basically described it right there. You know, just moments where we have the opportunity to take a little time, so we do. But one is, getting back toward the episode, toward the end of episode 7, the Liverpool episode. You know, after the events of the karaoke, we see Ted in his hotel room signing the divorce papers, and that easily could have been, you know, just he gets them, he signs them, and done, or just cut to Ted signing the papers or whatever. But you know, there's another phrase called don't burn your steps, which is I believe it was Buster Keaton, but it might have been Charlie Chaplin. And don't burn your steps means, like, if Buster Keaton had said in a script, Buster goes to the cabinet and takes a teacup out and pours himself some tea, he wouldn't just, you know, pours himself his tea. He would go to the door, touch the door. Is everything okay? Right. He would open the door and then, you know, look for the teacup and, like, is it this teacup? No, is it, like, you know, really do every single thing they're supposed to do. Don't skip anything. So in that moment, we're doing both of those things. He's not burning his steps. We see him enter the room. We see him look at the papers. We see him sit down. He takes a breath. He grabs the pen. He signs it. We see him take a picture, and he sits back, and it, like, there's grace notes there. You know, we're just taking our time with this moment. There are no jokes. But by that point in the show, you know that there have been jokes. You know that there will be jokes. We hopefully have your trust by that point. Therefore, we're going to take a grace note before we carry on.
Well, you have my trust, and I've seen you get asked a lot of times, like, do you feel any pressure now about season two? Because season one's gotten all these awards. And you're like, we wrote season two before. Like, we were doing this before. But I am, like, I have Jordan in 1997 level confidence. Like, when I would watch the Bulls in 1997 in the playoffs, I'm like, I know how the game's gonna end. The Bulls are gonna win. I know season two is gonna be good. I know it's gonna be great. I don't have any questions. I don't even, I'm fully, fully confident. Brendan Hunt, it's been so wonderful to get to talk to you. I hope we stay in touch. I can't wait for Ted Lasso. And again, congratulations on, I mean, I write about basketball every now and then, and I write columns, and they get thrown in the trash can after a day. You have created something really, really special. No, I'm being saccharine, but you should. It's amazing, and it's incredible what you've done. Thank you on behalf of all the millions of people who are going to watch this show for giving us something to look forward to.
Well, thank you, man. This is really a pleasure. To the question of other things to talk about, I have two basketball thoughts.
Let's go.
All right. One is, for people who are listening to this podcast who are basketball fans but not soccer fans, I just, if you haven't enough already, just I urge you to give soccer a shot, because the DNA is very similar, and mainly, you know, it's about flow. Like, the best soccer teams and the best basketball teams are trying to find flow. Just one of them has a clock and the other one doesn't. And And that's part of why Jason, the lifelong basketball guy, has been able to get into soccer by, you know, clicking into that. And secondly, I don't know if you've ever watched the Bulls 98 Finals Game 6 game on ESPN Classic. Have you ever watched, like, at home as opposed to, like, back in a bar back in the day?
Probably I have, but I rewatched it during The Last Dance and stuff, but I don't know if I specifically watched it on ESPN Classic.
One thing I noticed on an ESPN Classic viewing a while ago, because, you know, when it first happened, you know, I'm screaming and going nuts and can't hear a damn thing. But watching it, you know, flicking through channels once and watched it. So, you know, the game ends and it's celebratory and all the Bulls surround Jordan. And you can very clearly hear Steve Kerr shout on a hot mic before they would edit these things out, before they were on delay. Steve Kerr to probably Michael Jordan. You're f-ing amazing, man.
I got to see this. That's perfect. That's a perfect way to end. I also like to shout out Dusty Gunderson, big fan. Dusty, you're awesome. Brendan Hunt, Ted Lasso needs no more introduction. Thank you for spending some of your downtime with us because I know you don't have any. Brendan Hunt, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Zach. It's a pleasure. Cheers.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.